Welcome to the Deep Dive. We take a stack of information, sometimes a really complex stack, and distill it down into the knowledge you need.
The key insights.
Exactly. And today we're looking at something that, well, it hits close to home for many, especially here in areas like Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, places with so much water around.
Yeah, it's a constant presence.
And the hard fact is childhood drowning. It's the leading cause of death for kids under four. Just heartbreaking.
It truly is. And that statistic really highlights why we need to understand not just prevention, obviously crucial, but also what happens next. What happens when a child survives, but it's a non-fatal drowning.
Right. And that's our focus today. We're diving deep into one family's story, an incredibly powerful, very personal journey after their son, Robert, had a non-fatal drowning.
Yeah, a really difficult journey.
Our mission here is to unpack how they navigated this huge medical crisis, how it challenged the usual approaches, maybe revealed some startling things about the medical system, and how they found a path to recovery with alternative therapies.
And the goal for you, listening in our community, is to pull out that crucial knowledge, those aha moments. Useful if you ever face complex health choices or just want to understand brain injury better.
It's really a story about how focused action, local action, can have this ripple effect.
Absolutely. Our sources for this are really compelling. There's the family's own website, drownedbaby.org. It's incredibly detailed, very personal.
A real resource.
Totally. And then there's an interview with Robert's father on the Tom Woods Show.
Mm-hmm.
Very candid, sometimes a pretty shocking account. Gives a unique perspective.
Okay, so let's get into Robert's story. The drowning itself happened back on February 28, 2018.
Yeah.
He was found in a pond on their property. His sister actually pulled him out.
Mm-hmm.
They did CPR for about 45 minutes, got a heartbeat back, but then, just tragically, he lost it again in the ambulance.
Right. He was without a heartbeat, without breathing, mm-hmm. for about an hour, the father estimated.
An hour? That's significant. And later, much later, Robert actually explained he jumped in because his boot fell off.
Such a simple, childlike reason. Just gut-wrenching when you think about the consequences.
So he gets to the hospital, the pediatric ICU. And this is where things get, well, unsettling, according to the father.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. His account is that it seemed almost immediately like Robert was being, quote, staged for organ harvesting.
Staged? What did that look like?
Well, crucially, no intervention to control brain swelling. Nothing to protect the brain specifically. In fact, they apparently warmed him up.
Warmed him. But isn't cooling standard for brain injuries to reduce swelling?
Exactly. That's the standard hypothermia protocol. But the reason given, according to the father, was to protect his other organs, presumably for donation.
Wow. That's quite an allegation.
It is. And it sets the stage for what came next. The family says they were told repeatedly, sometimes by groups of doctors, up to five at once.
Five doctors?
Yes. Telling them everything that was Robert is gone. They felt intense pressure, to let him pass and to consider organ donation. The name Life Gift, a big organ procurement organization, came up frequently.
So the family felt pushed towards donation almost from the start.
They did. And it led them to this idea of a matrix, some kind of internal hospital system, they believe, for quickly deciding resource allocation based on perceived odds of survival.
It's like a calculation.
Yeah. Their conclusion was grim. Robert didn't survive the matrix. In their view, he was earmarked early on.
So what happened when they pushed back, when they said no to organ donation?
Well, things did change, the father said, quite quickly, but not necessarily in the direction of, you know, proactive healing therapies.
Meaning
few options were offered beyond drugs.
Yeah.
Drugs to control something called neurological storming.
Okay, storming. That sounds intense. What exactly is that?
It's basically the injured brain sending out chaotic signals. Like static or noise, it makes the body extremely toned, rigid.
How bad was it for Robert?
According to his dad, his body was literally bent backwards, arching severely, head almost touching his bottom, for 27 days straight.
27 days? That's unimaginable. And the drugs they used?
Things like gabapentin, baclofen, benzodiazepines. The family points out these were often off-label for kids, potentially toxic.
Off-label? Hold on, we'll come back to that.
Yeah. And critically, the family felt these drugs were just masking symptoms, not actually healing anything. Their theory, which the source really emphasizes, is that these drugs might even get in the way of the body's own healing attempts.
Just managing the storm, not calming it at the source.
Just pretty much.
And what about the inflammation, the swelling, the hospital's approach?
The family described it as wait and see, which is puzzling because, you know, brain swelling usually peaks around 72 hours.
Right.
But the pressure for these life or death decisions, the organ donation talk, was happening much, much earlier, before that peak, before they arguably had a clear picture.
So no active measures to control swelling in those first critical days?
Apparently not, according to the father's account, which just delayed getting a real sense of his potential.
Okay, this is where the story pivots a bit. Robert's dad had some prior knowledge.
Yes, thankfully. From his own background as an injured diver, he knew about hyperbaric treatment, HBOT. He'd seen case studies.
Well, he asked for it.
Begged for it, is how he puts it. Morning and evening rounds, asking for HBOT.
Yeah.
But the hospital refused.
Why? What reason did they give?
Things like, we don't know anything about it, or we can't replicate Dr. Hartch's work, even though Dr. Hartch had published studies.
Dr. Hartch. He comes up later, right?
Yes, he becomes central. This refusal, though, was the turning point for the family. After 37 days in the hospital, they felt they had no choice. They had to get Robert out.
Where did they go?
They managed to arrange transport to a small, specialized hyperbaric clinic in New Orleans run by Dr. Paul Hartch.
The expert they mentioned.
The very one.
And the results, given the bleak picture painted initially.
They were, well, astonishing. Within just 2 days of starting the hyperbaric therapy.
Jeez.
2 days.
Yeah.
That severely arched back. It was straight.
Wow.
3 days later, he was starting to respond to them. Actually responding.
That must have felt like a miracle.
Absolutely. And by the end of that first week, he was watching his brothers on a FaceTime call and laughing.
Laughing after being told everything that was Robert is gone.
Exactly. The contrast is stark. His progress continued after that first intensive block of 40 dives over 2 months.
What does he look like now, years later?
Well, 7 years on, he's walking, talking, running, jumping, still working on reading, has some visual and fine motor challenges, but the recovery is profound.
It really shows what might have been possible earlier if...
if the intervention hadn't been delayed, yes.
So let's unpack this therapy, hyperbaric therapy.
Right.
What exactly is it? How does it work?
Okay, so basically, you place the patient inside a pressure vessel, a chamber.
Right.
Sometimes it's with pure oxygen. That's technically hyperbaric oxygen therapy or HBOT.
Mm.
But sometimes, like in Robert's initial case, it's just room air under increased pressure.
So increased pressure is the key.
Yes. That pressure increase does something really important.
Yeah.
It forces oxygen to dissolve directly into the blood plasma. Way more oxygen than the red blood cells can carry alone.
Okay, so you get super oxygenated plasma.
Exactly. And that plasma can reach areas of the brain or body that might be starved for oxygen due to injury or swelling, cutting off normal blood flow.
Makes sense.
But it's more than just delivering oxygen. It's thought to trigger healing mechanisms. It helps regenerate tiny blood vessels, angiogenesis. It has epigenetic effects.
Epigenetic, like changing gene expression.
Precisely. Think of it like flipping switches. Turning off genes related to inflammation and damage, and turning on genes related to healing and repair. It also seems to mobilize stem cells.
So it's actively promoting healing, not just supplying oxygen.
Right. It's kickstarting the body's own repair systems. It's also thought to help with something called reperfusion injury.
Reperfusion. That's when blood flow returns after it's been cut off.
Yes, like after a heart attack or stroke,
right.
Or in Robert's case, after his heart stopped. Sometimes the return of blood flow can cause his own wave of damage. HBOT seems to mitigate that.
So the potential uses are quite broad then.
Very broad. The source mentioned its potential for battlefield trauma, severe injuries. And then there are claims, which the source notes but doesn't necessarily endorse, about athletes using it for performance, longevity.
Yeah.
Even things like improving mitochondrial function.
Okay, it sounds incredibly promising, which brings us back to the big question. If it's so effective, why the resistance? Why wasn't it readily available at the major hospital for Robert's brain injury?
Right. The core issue seems to boil down to its off-label status for brain injury.
Off-label meaning it's not officially approved by, say, the FDA for that specific condition.
Exactly. Now, paradoxically, hyperbaric chambers do exist in major hospitals. They're FDA approved for maybe 15 or 16 specific things.
Like what?
Things like diabetic foot wounds that won't heal,
yep.
Crush injuries, carbon monoxide poisoning, gas gangrene, certain embolisms, but not TBI, not traumatic brain injury or anoxic brain injury like Robert's.
Hmm. But wait, you said the drugs they did give Robert were also off-label for kids.
That's the kicker, isn't it? The family certainly saw the contradiction. Drugs used off-label, apparently okay. But this therapy, which has been around in some form for like 360 years.
360 years?
Yeah, it's old technology fundamentally. And crucially, it's not patentable. No one company owns pressure.
Ah, so no one stands to make a huge profit from promoting it widely for new uses.
That's the implication the family draws. The father even mentioned hearing from a doctor within the drowning community who supposedly admitted he wouldn't push for it because there was no money in it.
That's cynical, if true.
It paints a challenging picture of medical priorities, certainly.
So, dealing with the hospital, knowing all this, how did the family navigate it? They couldn't just demand things, right?
No, they had to be incredibly careful. The father talked about couching everything as a question. Never accusatory. Always asking, could we try this? Or, what are your thoughts on this?
Trying to avoid conflict.
Exactly. He mentioned being aware of hospital security, potential repercussions. He even made light of his daily request for HBOT. Hey, 7 a.m., can we take him downstairs to the chamber now? Knowing the answer would be no, but keeping it on the table.
And did that careful approach work sometimes?
It seems it did for some things, like getting high-dose fish oil approved. They asked, and the hospital apparently couldn't really articulate a reason why it would be harmful, so they allowed it.
Interesting. So it wasn't just hyperbaric therapy then. What else did the family do? It sounds like a very comprehensive approach.
Oh, absolutely. HBOT was critical, but it was part of a bigger picture. They focused heavily on controlling inflammation.
Oh.
Besides the fish oil, they looked into hypothermia protocols themselves, used vitamin C, D, E, even CBD.
And nutrition. You mentioned the hospital food wasn't great.
Yeah, the father described it as junk food initially. His wife actually organized community breast milk donations.
Oh, wow.
The hospital refused that, but the push seemed to lead them to eventually approve a whole food organic feeding tube formula called Nourish.
So they were advocating constantly on multiple fronts.
Constantly. They also incorporated other therapies later on, like normobaric oxygen, just oxygen at normal pressure, functional neurology.
Which involves chiropractic sometimes.
Often, yes. Focused on nervous system function.
Mm-hmm.
And laser light therapy, aiming to improve circulation.
And you mentioned something earlier that seems simple, but maybe profound. Rest.
Yes. The father stressed this point. Healing a brain injury is, as he put it, a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah.
It takes huge amounts of energy. So allowing for deep, dedicated rest was vital.
And related to that, this idea about comatose patients.
Right. The insight that comatose kids hear everything. They remember things that are around them. Which just highlights how important it is to maintain a positive, hopeful environment. Talk to them, not just about them.
This whole story really drives home the power, the necessity of parental advocacy.
Absolutely. The father's advice is blunt. Never give up. And maybe even more critically, never leave your child alone in the hospital.
And they had a direct experience illustrating that.
They did. After they refused the organ donation, Robert was apparently moved into a noisy hallway. His condition immediately worsened. He went back into that severe C-shaped posture. They got him moved back, and he improved.
A stark example. Just being present makes a difference.
A potentially life-saving difference.
Mm-hmm.
It really emphasizes the vulnerability of patients in that environment.
Which leads us to why the father created the website, drownedbaby.org.
Exactly. His wife was spending, he estimated, over 40 hours a week just on the phone, repeating the same advice, sharing their experience with other families facing similar crises.
So the website became a way to share that knowledge more broadly.
Yes. It documents Robert's whole journey, pictures, updates. It's become this comprehensive resource for parents dealing with non-fatal drowning or other brain injuries. And its mission is ambitious, to change the way we deal with drowning and brain injury.
And it helps fund Robert's ongoing care, too.
It does, through donations. Therapy is a long road.
It's incredible how this one family's fight, documented online, has had such far-reaching effects.
It really has. They share these amazing stories. A boy named Hanzak in the Czech Republic, another child in Morocco, families found the website, followed the protocols.
And saw similar results.
Similar positive outcomes, yes. So much so that in the Czech case, the doctors apparently apologized to the family. They acknowledged the protocols worked in ways they didn't expect and actually changed their local practices based on it.
Wow. From a website based on one family's experience in the U.S. to changing medical practice in the Czech Republic, that's impact.
It truly shows how sharing information, even from a very personal local struggle, can create global change.
Speaking of local action impacting broader systems, the father also got involved with policy here in Texas.
He did. He engaged with Congressman Tan Parker about right to try laws?
Right to try. Those laws are meant to give patients access to unapproved treatments, right?
That's the idea. But the father highlighted a key limitation. The laws generally protect the hospital from liability if they grant access. They don't actually force the hospital to say yes.
Ah, so the power still rests with the institution. Parents can ask, but the hospital can still refuse without penalty under right to try.
Precisely. It's a step, but maybe not the solution many hope it is for accessing therapies like HBOT and resistant institutions.
So zooming out, what does Robert's story tell us about the bigger picture? About American medicine, especially relevant for us here in the Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena area, where water safety is such a concern.
Well, it certainly raises some tough questions based on this family's experience. It suggests some standard protocols, like warming instead of cooling for brain injury in certain contexts, might be no good, as the father put it, maybe even detrimental.
And potentially driven by other factors, like organ procurement readiness.
That was their strong suspicion. It also highlights a system where therapies that aren't patentable, that don't promise big profits, might face uphill battles for acceptance, regardless of potential benefit.
A resistance to cheap, effective solutions?
That's the concern raised. And also, this push for very early, potentially irreversible life or death decisions. Sometimes before the true picture of recovery potential is clear.
It's a sobering perspective that the system itself, even with dedicated professionals within it, can create these hurdles.
Yeah. And as the father said, given the prevalence of water here in Texas, it's not if you'll meet somebody with a drowned child, it's when. Texas and Florida lead the U.S. in these tragedies.
So this deep dive isn't just a story. It's really about empowering you, our listeners, our neighbors, to be informed advocates, to know the questions to ask.
Because being informed, being present, being persistent, it can make all the difference in navigating these incredibly tough situations.
Okay, so let's recap. We've looked at the serious challenges within conventional hospital responses to severe brain injury, as highlighted by one family's experience.
We've seen the really surprising dramatic effectiveness of alternative therapies, like hyperbaric treatment in their case.
And we've underscored the absolutely critical role of informed, persistent parental advocacy, never giving up.
It's a narrative filled with hope, incredible resilience, and the sheer courage it takes to challenge the system for someone you love.
And it leaves us and you with a provocative thought to mull over. If therapies exist, potentially life-saving, seemingly low-risk therapies, but they struggle for mainstream adoption, perhaps due to systemic or financial hurdles, what does that imply about our healthcare choices?
And more personally, how can you, right here in our community, prepare yourself to advocate for the best possible outcomes if you or your loved ones ever face a crisis?
We really encourage you to visit drownedbaby.org. Explore the site, read Robert's full story, see the resources available. It's powerful stuff. If you find value in our show, The Deep Dive, and believe in our mission to empower residents of Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, Texas, to improve their lives and community, please consider supporting us. You can find the link at thinkanddactlocally.com/donate. It's also in the show notes.